This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio. You're listening to the call of a fin whale in the western North Atlantic Ocean. Recorded with ocean bottom surveillance microphones by the U.S. Navy, the sound has been sped up by a factor of 10 to make it audible for human ears. Otherwise, the call of the fin whale is at a frequency too low for us to detect. Welcome to the second installment of The Coastal Citizen, an 8-part series where we explore the issues, challenges, and opportunities of life on the coast. I'm your host, Erica Butler. On this episode of The Coastal Citizen, we take a look at a global industry taking root off the shores of the Atlantic coast and the concerns being raised about the risks and dangers it poses to our coastal ecosystems. Offshore oil and gas development is high stakes, to be sure. Companies involved are global giants: BP, ExxonMobil, Shell, Chevron, and Encana. The Nova Scotia government took in $225 million in oil and gas royalties for the 2010-11 fiscal year. Newfoundland took in $1.24 billion. While numbers like that may seem hard to resist, there's many who say that the risks and impacts of drilling offshore are just not worth the payoff. We start off our journey with a friend of the fin whale, Dr. Lindy Weilgaard. An adjunct professor in the biology department at Dalhousie University, Dr. Weilgaard has a particular interest in ocean noise and its effect on marine life. One of the first steps in oil and gas exploration is the seismic survey. Oil and gas prospectors send massively loud sound blasts down through the water and into the ocean floor in an effort to find oil and gas, or at least locate the geological formations that are likeliest to contain them. The trouble is, in the meantime, they cause major disruption for the marine life surrounding them. I started off asking Dr. Weilgaard to explain some of the key effects of offshore seismic testing.
Seismic air gun noise is just a ecosystem-wide invasive stressor, in that it probably impacts all levels of the ecosystem. You know, where we're finding that even invertebrate larvae, like scallop larvae, are developmentally delayed or deformed, all the way up to whales that depend heavily on sound, as do most marine animals. So we're worried about the fish, we're worried about squid, other invertebrates, we're snow crabs, you name it. that is, all of them are likely impacted to some degree by this extremely intense noise, and the reason it is so dangerous is because it's like a gunshot. So it's a very high rise time. It goes from no sound to suddenly, you know, 260 decibels, which is phenomenally loud. And so not only are we concerned about hearing damage, of course, you know, these surveys carry on for months at a time often, and even at farther ranges, you know, hearing damage can happen. And, you know, we're concerned about stress impacts, changes in feeding, breeding, vocalizing, obliterating the sounds that they need to survive, pretty much the whole range.
Do we know conclusively anything about what effects have happened from seismic testing that's already happened?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's just a wealth of literature. Now, this, I just have to say a caveat that it's very hard to find these impacts because the ocean is not a controlled system. You know, all sorts of things change oceanographically, and so it's often hard to link one effect to one cause, right? But there's certainly a large body of literature showing these impacts. So when I say, you know, we're worried about these things, I'm not saying it on a theoretical sense. I'm saying that there are, you know, just a wealth of studies here that that show, for instance, fin whales falling silent during the months that a seismic survey was happening and then starting singing right after. You know, fairly strong correlation there. And, you know, when fin whales stop singing, that's how they find their mates. So very likely a population impact there. We have whales changing their migration routes. We have catch rates in fisheries dropping by 80% or so. Fish schooling differently, bunching up, you know, getting out of the area. We have a lot of avoidance of important habitat. You know, there's just a myriad of studies.
Give us a description of what exactly is happening when someone is, say, on the Scotian Shelf doing seismic testing, looking for natural gas or oil deposits.
You know, it sounds very much like a gunshot, very intense, and it's just a bunch of very high air released under extremely high pressure, so high pressure that if you handle the air gun while it went off, it would blow your arm off, okay? So it's not a chemical explosion, but you might as well think of it as such. It's not much different. So then the sound travels through, you know, it can travel through kilometers of ocean, first of all through the water, and then it penetrates into the ocean floor another sometimes hundreds of kilometers. So if you consider the sound that's required to get through several kilometers of ocean and then hundreds of kilometers of ocean floor, right, the Earth's crust, and then back again because they need to get that echo. So the echo is going to be very quiet, right? So that's why you have to pour such an enormous amount of energy into this shot to get it all through that distance.
Right. And the echo coming back is the information that they're going to get from this.
So
right?
the echo will tell them what the makeup of the ocean floor is, are the features there that would promote the presence of oil, or you know, can they actually see with sound the oil deposits?
But it's not just one very loud air gun shot.
No. It's given every 10 to 12 seconds, you know, around the clock for months at a time. It's sort of a lawnmower pattern or a racetrack pattern. They'll just go around and around, and this area will just be flooded with intense sound. Sound, you know, you have to understand that sound travels extremely well underwater. It travels almost five times the speed in air. And so you can have, you know, one very loud sound travel these phenomenal distances, which is why marine animals are so sensitive to it, because they use that same quality of seawater, you know, that efficient transmission of sound. That's what they use, too, to transmit their own sounds and to learn about their environment.
So if we were to find an analogy to, you know, land life, is there any way to, like, draw a picture of what this must be like for marine mammals and fish?
I guess the closest would be an explosion in a rainforest. If you're picking an area that is very rich in marine life, you know, it's setting off explosives in a rainforest is the best I could come up with. But even there, I mean, you have to consider that an oil field, you know, it's first you start with the exploration, but then you know, even if there's not a spill, you got all the supply boats, you got all the garbage, you know, it's from cradle to grave, it's a very invasive process, right? Just shouldn't be done, you know. I mean, there we have to have some limits, and you know, the Arctic I don't think is appropriate either. The cleaning up after a spill becomes so difficult, and all of this. So I think some areas just need to be out of bounds.
That was the sound of a seismic air gun blast from the Maurice Ewing, a seismic research vessel that was responsible for the death of two beaked whales. Occasionally, a whale stranding can be linked to a particular vessel if location and timing correlate. But Wilgart says, for the most part, we just don't find the bodies. The ocean is just too vast, and bodies sink and are eaten before we're able to spot them. Only about 3% of whale carcasses are ever found by humans. That number goes up in heavily studied populations, like the killer whales off the BC coast, but even then, when every single whale is known and identified, only about 7% of deceased whales are ever found, which makes establishing the direct effects of seismic surveys difficult. I continued my chat with Lindy Wilgart by asking her about the techniques the oil and gas prospectors use to help mitigate the effects of their seismic surveys on marine life. Here's Dr. Lindy Wilgart again.
Well, let me tell you about mitigation. You know, the only mitigation that really works is putting the sound in areas that are not full of life, you know, the deserts of the ocean, and using the very quietest sound possible, you know, really quieting the sound. So the air gun shot is across all pitches and frequencies. But they're only interested in anything under 200 hertz, which is quite low. It's very low frequency. So they don't even record anything over 200 hertz. And that signal goes up easily to 100 kilohertz, right? So you've got all these frequencies, these higher frequencies that are put out that aren't even used, you know? And that's where most of marine life is sensitive. So, I mean, yes, it won't help the blue whales and the fin whales, the more low-frequency specialists, but it would help the dolphins. It probably wouldn't help many species of fish. It seems inexcusable that they would pour this amount of sound in when they don't even use it, right? And there are technological fixes for that. There is something called a marine vibrosize, which is what we use on land. So you have a longer signal, but it's just a lot quieter. It's just not as loud. And we can do the same for the ocean. And prototypes exist for this, and they're just not being built. So that's another reason why I think it's insane to be using air guns. Those are the only mitigations that have any real effectiveness. But what is done are these marine mammal observers. They're put on ships, on seismic ships, and they're supposed to look at whales out to 500 meters. And when they spot them, then the survey is supposed to shut down. Well, that's better than nothing. I mean, it's not useless, but it's barely better than nothing. Whales, especially the deep-diving northern bottlenose whale, they can dive for hours. You know, they can dive to whatever, 2,000, 3,000 meters, right? So, and you'll miss so many of them, and it's foggy, and they do these surveys round the clock. So at night, it's going to be useless. So, you know, it is better than nothing, but just barely, and it's certainly nothing we can say, oh, well, we can, you know, shoot seismic in critical habitat as long as we have these marine mammal observers. That's nonsense. And even listening for their sounds, they're not always vocal. You can't identify where the sound's coming from. You don't know how far it is. You don't often know which species. I mean, it's just not good enough. It's that sort of mitigation is almost window dressing. It's a feel-good measure that is really not doing a whole lot to protect the animals. The main thing you have to do is stay out of that area.
What areas around the East Coast should we be looking at protecting from things like oil and gas development then?
The trouble with noise is it doesn't respect boundaries. So even if you say, well, we'll not allow oil exploration in our marine protected area, that's not good enough. You have to have enough of a buffer zone. You have to have, you know, the sound shouldn't get into the marine protected area above a certain level, right? So we have to really look beyond what's actually done in the protected area to influences outside of it. What frustrates me about these petroleum boards, I just think they're a joke because, you know, they're even selling leases in critical habitats. Off the Scotian Shelf here, we have critical habitat right next to the marine protected area in Shortland and Haldimand Canyons. Those are designated critical habitat for the northern bottlenose whale, and leases are sold on top of those areas. Like, what is the point? And even the gully, I mean, seismic is going on now where levels are reaching the gully marine protected area that I think are way too high. So those, I think, need to be protected much better. If you consider, you know, the bottlenose whale, it's the numbers are, I don't know, in the 80s or 100 or so. And that's all they use. They have this tiny little area. They're in it year round, 8 by 12 kilometers. I mean, surely we can give them that much, you know. And you know, Gulf of St. Lawrence is extremely productive, very sensitive. That should be avoided. The Arctic should be avoided. George's Bank, you know. These are threatening fisheries and tourist industries, and it's just not appropriate to be searching for oil there.
Mm-hmm. Seismic seems like the most sort of dramatic noise issue, but there are a lot of other issues with noise in the ocean.
Well, you know, yeah, I do focus on air guns, the seismic air guns for the seismic surveys that the oil and gas industry does. But in fact, the oil and gas industry uses a lot of other noise sources. They use multi-beam echo sounders, and one of those has been very highly correlated with a stranding of something like 100-150 melon-headed whales in Madagascar. So, you know, air guns, yeah, they're a big problem. They may not be the only problem, specifically with the oil and gas industry. We do know that mid-frequency naval sonars are also extremely damaging and extremely cause these fatal injuries as well. So we just don't know the extent of the problem. But, of course, the more we look, the more we find. And that goes for noise sources. It goes for different species being affected, ones that we never would have thought would really be vulnerable. Things like squid, where they don't even have an air bladder, you know. Air is a good reflector of sound. And where squid don't even have an air bladder, you're thinking, you know, swim bladder, well, they should be fine. You know, the sound just goes through them. Even they are mass stranding, you know. So every time we underestimate the damage here.
That was Dr. Lindy Weilgart. Over the summer of 2014, BP Canada is running a fleet of 5 to 10 seismic vessels over a section of the Scotian Shelf, almost 8,000 kilometers squared. You're listening to Episode 2 of The Coastal Citizen, a look at the concerns of oil and gas exploration in coastal regions of the Atlantic. One of the areas that Lindy Weilgart thinks is best avoided by the oil and gas industry is the Gulf of St. Lawrence, where already more than 60,000 kilometers of seismic surveys have been conducted and 10 exploration wells have been drilled. Now, as another exploration well stands poised to be approved for drilling, people are organizing their opposition. This summer, while the Assembly of First Nations chiefs gathered in Halifax, a group of Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, and Innu chiefs from nations around the Gulf of St. Lawrence got together to make a statement.
We demand that this race to drill in the Gulf be stopped. Canadians and our nations must be heard. No drilling without a proper assessment. The social good demand this. The Atlantic fishery, our economy, our way of life, and the life of the ecosystem must take precedent over oil.
That was Chief Claude Jeannot from the Mi'kmaq Nation of Gaspeg. Along with his fellow chiefs, Jeannot is asking for a 12-year moratorium on drilling in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, the semi-enclosed sea surrounded by Newfoundland, Quebec, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and Nova Scotia. The Gulf is considered one of the largest and most productive marine ecosystems in the world. Jeannot and his fellow chiefs are in agreement. They want a full ecosystem impact assessment on the effects and risks of drilling in the Gulf before any further exploration is allowed to occur. And they would like that assessment done by someone other than the offshore petroleum boards currently tasked with both building and regulating the offshore oil and gas industry on the East Coast. Recently, one of those boards, the Canada-Newfoundland Offshore Petroleum Board, completed a strategic environmental assessment of the industry for the Newfoundland corner of the Gulf. The report concluded that oil exploration could proceed in the area with the application of standard mitigation measures. The report did identify some sensitive fish spawning grounds, and in those cases, recommended non-standard mitigation measures. Nowhere was deemed off-limits to oil exploration. It's terms like mitigation measures that are raising alarm bells with those concerned about the potential effects of an oil spill in the Gulf, especially when the world witnessed botched mitigation and cleanup in the Gulf of Mexico as recently as 2010.
It could turn out to be the worst environmental disaster in more than 20 years.
Thousands of gallons of crude oil are oozing into the Louisiana coastal waters 10 days now after that oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico.
And this afternoon, rescue crews cleaned their first bird found coated with oil, which is being spilled at a rate of 5,000 barrels every day. It could take up to 3 months to drill a relief well to plug the leak. And at the current rate of leakage, this spill would eclipse the Exxon Valdez disaster in Alaska back in 1989.
The massive Deepwater Horizon spill in 2010 was caused by a blowout on an exploratory well looking for oil. The hole in the ocean floor gushed an estimated 4.9 million barrels of oil, the largest spill in U.S. history. Deepwater Horizon is perhaps most notorious for the remarkably long time it took to cap the oil well, 87 days. Troy Jerome is a spokesperson for the Mi'kmaq Way Mawiomi, an association of Mi'kmaq communities from northern New Brunswick and the Gaspé Peninsula of Quebec.
The oil industry is out there saying, you know what, we could do this, we could do that. They have not prove that they can do it safely. They can't even prove that they can do it safely in the Gulf of Mexico. How would they even imagine going out in the subarctic conditions as the Gulf of St. Lawrence and say, oh, we could do it. It's just a matter of doing it effectively safely. They have done very little investment in terms of improving their offshore exploration process. They spend monies on other things, on trying to gain social acceptability and, you know, having their nice commercials on TV, clean oil, but they are not spending the money where they need to be. I remember when the Gulf of Mexico was going on, that spill. When I talk to people, I'm like, I make examples like, let's throw spaghetti down there in the hole today. Let's throw M&Ms down there. Let's try to figure out how we can stop it. What have they done since then to try to be able to say, no, we can do this? They cannot assure the Mi'kmaq at this point to say, if we do this, we can do it safely.
Currents in the Gulf of St. Lawrence run in a counterclockwise pattern, flushing outward over time, sort of like a reverse toilet. Any spill, it's feared, would stay in the Gulf long enough to be circulated around the coastline of five provinces before finally being washed out to the Atlantic Ocean. The Gulf is also ice-covered for a good part of the year, and weather conditions have been known to occasionally ground ferries crossing the Northumberland Strait. It's not hard to see where the skepticism about the potential for mitigation measures comes from. Mary Gorman is a volunteer activist with the Save Our Seas and Shores Coalition, based out of Marigamish, Nova Scotia.
They may be experts at getting oil out of the ocean's floor, but they are nowhere near experts at preventing, stopping, or cleaning up oil spills. There's a huge difference there. If there was a spill at Old Harry, they could be days before they'd even get there because of weather conditions. And when you couple that with the fact that the Gulf has these counterclockwise currents, so that any oil spilled is not going to flush out for an entire year because of these currents that are going to take it all over the Gulf.
Right now, Halifax-based Corridor Resources owns the lease on Old Harry, a possible oil reserve located deep under the ocean floor between the Magdalen Islands and the west coast of Newfoundland. The company has until January 2016 to start drilling, and currently stands poised to get approval from the Canada-Newfoundland Offshore Petroleum Board to do just that, with a pending environmental review on the books. Even with an exploratory well, Mary Gorman thinks it's not worth the risk.
The hard reality is that there is no possible way to clean up an oil spill in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And if they are going to proceed knowing that, then they better be ready to assume the liability of destroying the renewable resources that feed over 55,000 jobs out of five provinces. There is no way you can even compare what our fishery and our tourism industries give to Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, Quebec, and Newfoundland. You cannot even compare versus ugly-looking rigs and short-term jobs for a handful of people.
The diverse fishery around the Gulf generates $1.5 billion in economic activity, from catching and processing salmon, snow crab, shrimp, lobster, herring, and other species. Another $800 million has been brought in by the tourism industry. The irony of the situation, according to Mary Gorman, is that Gulf fishers were among the first to embrace sustainable techniques.
What our politicians fail to appreciate, what Megan Leslie fails to appreciate, and what Stephen Harper and all of them fail to appreciate, is that our fishermen in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, our inshore fishermen, have fought for decades to create sustainable fisheries. They were leaders. Ecology Action Center, 15 years ago, gave an award to the inshore fishermen in the Gulf of St. Lawrence because they were the first fishermen, probably in the world, to voluntarily ban groundfish gear. They did it themselves because DFO didn't even implement it. They banned the rock roller gear so that they weren't violating every breeding region on the ocean's floor, with that very destructive groundfish gear. They have fought for decades to protect our fishery. And now that they're facing this Goliath of a global oil industry, they find they have no supporters in our elected officials to take up the battle that they have so valiantly taken on for themselves to make their fisheries sustainable.
Despite the strong combined statement coming from Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, and Innu chiefs from around the Gulf, Troy Jerome is not optimistic about the odds of a voluntary moratorium by the federal and provincial governments involved.
We're being consulted very little at the strategic level, and it seems at the strategic level there's a lot of gaps, a lot of concerns by the scientists and the people doing the environmental studies, but it appears that the government's trying to go forward. So we figured with an alliance of all our brothers and sisters, if we could convince the government to do these long-term studies, we would be in better shape. And if they don't, then an alliance together, when we go to court, would be able to stand in front of a judge and say, "Judge, you know, we have these kind of interests in the Gulf. You need to recognize those, as the Supreme Court did in Marshall, and to force the government to do its proper studies." When we look at it at today, I would say it looks like we are going towards a legal battle. That could change, you know. I think if we can continue to show that there is a high level of, you know, social unacceptability, that the government may slow down their pace and may do what they're supposed to be doing.
If a legal battle over the Gulf ensues, the allied First Nations hope they will also find support from other groups like Save Our Seas and Shores, the David Suzuki Foundation, and the St. Lawrence Coalition, who just published an 80-page report outlining the environmental concerns over oil and gas in the Gulf. In the meantime, Troy Jerome feels that the call for a temporary moratorium is just plain practical. If there's oil in Old Harry, it won't be going anywhere for another 12 years. And it would be foolhardy to start drilling without a scientific consensus on the risks.
We would like people to think that the Mi'kmaq and the other First Nations are not being dramatic, that we're not trying to say not in our backyard like a lot of other projects. But what we see is that if there's going to be oil exploration in there, that's a dramatic decision by the government. They don't need oil today. Let's take the time. Let's put a 12-year or more moratorium. Let's study the Gulf as a whole. Right now, there's no proven reserve. It's just a salt dome that people look at, geological formation, that they say it has the potential to have oil. Let's check it out. We're saying, you know what? It's too expensive. The risk is too high just to check if there's oil and gas in there so that we could have richer people come in and extract that oil. If they ruin our shores, they ruin the ability to fish for salmon, you know, snow crab, shrimp, that is something we could not turn the tides back on.
That's all for this episode of The Coastal Citizen. Next week, we look at why and how we treat the ocean like a garbage dump, how it's affecting us, and what we're doing to clean it up. The Coastal Citizen is produced at CKDU-FM in Halifax, with funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I've been your host, Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.